Donna Llewellyn is the Executive Director of the Institute for Inclusive and Transformative Scholarship. She came up in academia through engineering and helped with the push to welcome more women into the field. Please welcome Donna Llewellyn.
Thank you. And let me add my welcome to Boise State. We're glad that you're all here. The office I direct, which is called the Institute for Inclusive and Transformative Scholarship, is better known by its acronym, IFITS. And anybody who's been in a meeting with me knows that I then say, IFITS, you fits, we all fits. The unfortunate truth is that that statement is an aspiration. We all know that our structures and systems were not built for everyone to fit. And in fact, many were created specifically to exclude some particular population groups. My early work, as was stated, was in the area of women in engineering. When I was first starting out as an engineering faculty member at a different institution, I had suits that had large shoulder pads. It helped me fit in with my male colleagues. When I started to work to support our students who identified as female, I realized quickly that we also needed to change our systems and structures to make this artificial fitting in unnecessary, and that I'd earned the position and privilege to start working on dismantling those biased systems and structures from the inside, working with other women engineering faculty and students, and partnering with others who had the power to change things. Luckily, those shoulder pads were removable, and I could eventually return to wearing clothes that don't masquerade who I am. I will add, for anyone who's my age, those that had Velcro were handy for when the overwhelmingly masculine academy and engineering became overwhelming. So when I was asked to say a few words for this session, I jumped at the opportunity because of the incredibly important topic of the upcoming panel. It is not new to anyone in this room that there's a connection, and not a positive one, between the effects of climate change and other environmental issues on women in the LGBTQ plus community. It is critical that people who have privilege and power work to ensure that those who are most negatively impacted are also educated and empowered to dismantle those systems and structures that are causing the harm. How these topics are covered in the media, how we share information about those connections, and the negative impacts on certain segments of the population is critical. How we can report on the current situation while also working to change it, so that in the future we don't see such terrible impacts cause racism and sexism and other harms on these populations. How can we help women and the LGBTQ plus population to survive today's world while also working to help them change the systems and structures so that they don't suffer in a future world? Unfortunately, I don't have a corresponding metaphor for my old shoulder pads, but I'm hopeful that we can educate and serve while also empowering people to change the world to one where everyone can not only fit, but can thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Next on the stage, we have a producer with CNN's Health and Climate Unit and a standout reporter with CNN.com. Come on up. Jen Pierce is our moderator. She just got an MFA at Bennington College in creative nonfiction and, like I think everyone in this room, right, she's working on a book. And she is here to moderate the lunch plenary. Please applaud Jen.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh my gosh, look at all of you. This is so exciting to see so many people here for this conversation. I am thrilled to be here and excited to be among this wonderful group of women. I think you're in for a real treat. When we were preparing for this conversation, we were discussing whether or not people even could see the connections between gender, climate, and LGBTQ community issues. And so I want to make sure that we address this specifically, because some of you may not be thinking this way, and then some of you may be covering this every day, right? So, and thrilled that we finally get to talk about things that we aren't supposed to talk about in polite society, right? Sex, politics, religion, and climate change, right? This is all in this panel. This is very exciting, and I think you're in for a real treat. Again, my name is Jen Christensen. I'm a producer with CNN and a writer for CNN.com. I cover climate through a health lens. I'm a part of the health health group. I'm also the National Board Secretary for NLGJA, which is the Association of LGBTQ plus Journalists, the convention co-chair. If you want a style guide, we have style guides. So let me talk about our wonderful panel today. So we have Lorena Aguilar, who is a gender leader passionate about human rights, inclusion, and sustainable development. An anthropologist by training from Costa Rica, she's been working at the intersection of gender and environment for more than 35 years. She started at a time, she said, when everyone thought she was absolutely crazy for talking about the linkage between gender and environmental degradation and climate change. Now, clearly, we see her wisdom. She worked for more than 30 years as the Global Senior Gender Advisor at IUCN, served as Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs for her country, and is now back in the U.S. at the Kashuk Institute, a new organization working on women and girls' empowerment with a main focus on sustainability. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jen.
Then next we have Gina DeHung. She is the Director of Technical Excellence Department at IPAS. She joined IPAS North Carolina in October of 2013 and has worked in the field of sexual and reproductive rights for over 15 years. At IPAS, Gina has overseen the interdisciplinary technical strategies employed at IPAS to support sustainable abortion ecosystems all around the world. IPAS is a global NGO that works to ensure access to safe abortion, particularly in restricted settings. While the organization works primarily in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, due to recent politics, she's been a little busier here in the United States. Prior to IPAS, Gina was a staff attorney with a reproductive health team at the National Health Law Program, where she focused on enforcement of reproductive rights under the federal Medicaid statute and the ACA. Ali Orr is a recent graduate of this very campus, class of 2022. She is already setting the world on fire. This marketing major created a scholarship while at Boise State for women in STEM, medicine, and law while she was still a student here. She did that after one of her professors had the gall to say that women don't belong in science, medicine, or law. Mm. She has raised hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we'll have a slide so you can also contribute, to make sure that people have scholarships, women have scholarships, to be able to continue to go to school and to make sure that they continue in these professions. And we'll get into that in a little bit. Thank you so much for being here. And then finally, we have Amy. Many of us know Amy. She's been on 100 panels. If you don't already know her, she's a multiple award-winning founder and executive producer of Critical Frequency, an all-women climate-focused podcast company that won the ONA Award for Audio Excellence in 2019, the Covering Climate Now Award for Audio in 2021, and a Peabody nomination in 2022. And I'm sure she will get a Peabody. I just know it.
One of these.
She's been a climate journalist for the past two decades, and she started her podcast company about 8 years ago. She's also the host of one fabulous podcast called Drilled, if you haven't heard it yet. It's a true crime podcast that looks at climate change, and it's amazing. And in all her spare time, she somehow writes regularly for The Guardian and The Intercept. So you can see, we have like the powerful panel here, right? So I just wanted to start, with a philosophical question, and kind of level set. Since there are people who probably don't understand the intersection of these two topics, let's talk about it. How do gender, climate, and LGBTQ communities intersect? Why is that important for people to understand that? Do you want to start?
Yes, I can. First, thank you very much for the invitation. We have to understand that, yes, climate change affects everyone, but it affects differently women and men and other marginalized and vulnerable communities. We're going to talk later about that. We also have a different effect. I mean, we also are agents of change. But I don't like philosophy, Jen. I also want to talk about the people that are having this differentiated impact. So sea level rise. Everybody says, oh, yes, I mean, sea level rise is affecting us the same. But when we were in Bangladesh, working for developing the gender and climate change strategy for the government, and we were at the communities at the end of the delta, and the sea was causing the wells to have saltier water, I mean, salty water. And we started seeing that pregnant women were having eclampsia and preeclampsia, that is a disease where your blood pressure rises because you can develop this. But while they were drinking the same water that everybody else, it triggered it that in that specific region, 30% increase on that type of disease. So sea level rise, climate change, women, it does have a differentiated impact. But it also has an impact when the knots of gender inequality restricts your possibility to confront climate change. For example, if you have less access to education, or you have less access to land. And again, let me bring you a story about a woman in Honduras during Mitch. This was an event that happened many, many years ago, but one of the strongest hurricanes in our region. And Doña Vera was living in the coast of the Atlantic, and her friend said, Vera, there are winds of 200 kilometers coming. And she said, how much are 200 kilometers? Vera had never had a possibility to go to school. And then her friend said, let's walk by the river, by the estuarium, something that you don't do, but they have never been involved in any time of prevention. And then she goes with her kids. She lost two of her kids in the process of being in a tree for many days. And then she gets to a refugee camp. She's raped while she was there. And when she comes back, an NGO comes and said, there's nothing left of her house. And the NGO said, you only have to give us one thing, and it was their titles for their property, which she didn't have. So that is how climate change affects women and men and people that are marginalized in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Gina?
Yeah, thank you. I think my mic is on. Can you hear me? So for IPASS, we believe, first off, I'll say, abortion is healthcare. It's more than that to more people, but at its core, it's healthcare. It's not political. It's not a crime unless we make it so. And at IPASS, we believe that every person has the right to direct their own lives, that they have the right to self-determine, you know, all aspects, not just their sexual and reproductive health, but their education, their jobs, their safety and security. And abortion is a challenge almost everywhere in the world. You could spin a globe and land your finger somewhere, and it's very likely that wherever you are, it will be hard. It would be hard to get an abortion if you needed one. There would be challenges. And the work that we do in humanitarian and climate crisis settings also demonstrates what a crisis it becomes in these settings, because there's a higher risk for women and girls, especially, of exploitation, sexual violence, and compounding that, access to sexual and reproductive health care, especially abortion, is often invisible in any of the refugee settlement camps or camps where people are being displaced. So it's really clear that, you know, not just on any given day is it a challenge, but when there is a crisis, when people are displaced, when they have to leave their homes, there are disparities in what women and girls are largely responsible for in terms of their family, the health and security of themselves, and the care that they have available. So, yeah, I'll stop there.
Yeah. Thank you for the the question. I kind of want to focus on the education aspect of this, of when we have all of the issues, when we have structural issues, how can we expect to advocate for women if women aren't there in the first place? If women don't have the education to be there, how can we advocate for their help? And a really important aspect of this is not only motivating women to be involved in STEM and sciences, but how to retain women there. If those aren't safe circumstances to be in, if they don't feel welcome, if they don't feel like they can raise their voice, how do we create solutions to issues that directly impact women and other groups? And just as they were saying as well, is these issues impact women more, so they're having to do twice as much work just to show up every single day. And so the scholarship that I created hopefully takes away some of those barriers, that financial barrier, that safety barrier of, do I even belong here? So I think it's really, really important to ensure that women feel safe in these these educational spaces.
Amy?
Yeah. Sorry for my ill-timed coughing. So I focus mostly on accountability reporting, so that's where this like intersection is very clear to me, because all of the organizations and politicians and specific operatives who are working against women's rights, trans rights, reproductive rights, civil rights of all kinds are the same folks that are working against climate action. There is a one-to-one, I mean, it's a perfect circle. So the idea that these issues are separate, it doesn't map to reality. The funding, lobbying, and political organizing that is working against abortion rights right now and against trans rights in this country is the exact same apparatus that's working to stop climate policy. Another really direct intersection is, actually I saw this on the IPAS website, that I think it's like of the 26 million people who have had to migrate due to climate impacts so far, 20 million are women. So there's a huge kind of over-representation of women when it comes to climate impacts, but not usually when it comes to, you know, crafting the solutions to dealing with those impacts. So, just two areas that seem, you know, like easy access points for reporters to start to look at.
To bounce off of that, I was reading some peer-reviewed studies about how women are disproportionately impacted by natural disasters. And it said, you know, women are 14 times more likely to die in a natural disaster. And it said that there's, and it's even a greater likelihood in cultures where there's an unequal power dynamic. Women, you know, so forget the women and children first in the lifeboats. Women are left behind, or they're taking care of everyone, and they're the last to go. It said that in a crisis, when there's food that's short, women are the last to eat. So something as simple as in a lot of countries, women are not taught to swim. So if you have flooding, they're in trouble. Or the clothing that they're made to wear is restrictive, and they can't run away from danger. These are peer-reviewed studies that the UN knows about, certainly. People are well aware of this information. But how often is that taken into consideration? Lorena, do you think people think about this?
Well, as you well said, 30 years ago, no. In the organizations that I had been working, we have been updating ministers, because you never train a minister. You update them on the latest. So, and these linkages of gender and climate change. And today we have 120 mandates in the convention on climate change. And we have more countries paying attention to these linkages. The problem is to go from the talking to the doing. Implementation is the challenge. How do you really develop the initiatives? But we also, Jen, has to move away from seeing women only like the vulnerables, the weak ones, the ones that need to be taken care of, and also see the report that UNF report said that we are 8 billion people in the world right now. We women are 4 billion solutions to climate change. So we're just also part of the solution. So I think that every day we're moving a little bit. 30 years ago, it was crazy to even think about that. But there's still a lot of work to be done.
Gina, I know you see examples all the time of of women-run organizations. Can you give us some good examples?
Yeah, so we, you know, from our research, we are certainly finding data consistent with what you're sharing in Mozambique after the cyclones. In Mozambique, women tend to disproportionately be responsible for food production and farming, but the government displacement camps were not located near those settings, so that role was really disrupted. Women often bear the responsibility of taking care of the family, keeping the family together, feeding the family first. So it makes it more challenging for them to be able to migrate to do work as compared with men who can leave for long periods of time to do work and then come back. So a lot of these challenges, just being, you know, having a more nomadic lifestyle where you have to move to work and then come back home, what we find is more exposure to violence, exploitation, families that are more likely to, you know, have their children sold off basically early, and child forced marriages are happening more frequently. But I think to get to your sort of like the heart of the question, and maybe even why we are talking about abortion specifically on this panel, one thing that we know from our work is that abortion is very much a bellwether for gender equality, that if you are denying the bodily autonomy and the self-determination of a person who is pregnant but doesn't want to be pregnant to make a decision about that, then it is very likely you're denying a lot of other rights. And so you can know everywhere that it's challenging to get an abortion, it's probably also more challenging on other aspects of health, education, economics, for women more generally. So, you know, it helps us, and it's not surprising when we see the data that we see in our research, because we already know that bodily autonomy, self-determination are at risk everywhere. But what's really concerning to us is, like I said earlier, how invisible sexual and reproductive health care and abortion in particular is, despite the increased risk of sexual violence, the need for this service. You know, it's important to focus, of course, on food and emergency medicine, but this is something that must also be present, and it simply isn't. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. Amy, can you tell me a little more about some of the connections, since, you know, if this is a bellwether for equality, you've been talking about the overlap in organizations. Can you tell us a little more?
Specific groups? Yeah, I mean,
because these would be good stories for people. These would be good stories for people to do.
Yeah, I mean, the organizations that I look at a lot for anti-climate lobbying, like the Heritage Foundation, the Heartland Institute. There's a new organization that Jordan Peterson just launched called the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. It combines kind of all of the cast of characters who've been fighting against climate policy, including folks like Norm Lomborg, Vivek Ramaswamy, who's been kind of the leader of the anti-ESG crowd for a while, as well as leaders in anti-feminist movements, men's rights activists, anti-LGBTQ trans folks, anti-abortion folks, and the politicians who do their bidding from the US, Canada, and Australia. So that's not unique. There are a lot of these kinds of organizations. They crop up all the time. This one just started in January. And I suspect that we will see, you know, either they will morph into a new organization next year, or there will be a new one that kind of reconfigures all these people together as well. And they often have a lot of the same funding. You know, if you look at like where the Koch brothers are funding things, it's across the spectrum of, you know, reducing voter rights, anti-abortion, or as they call it, pro-family, religious freedom, or, you know, the lack thereof in most cases. So yeah, I think it really is, it's like one machine that's working on all of these things all at once. So if, as climate journalists, or I know some people in this room are climate activists or organizers or whatever, if you're not thinking in that intersectional way, you will lose. these folks are like very organized. They've been together on the same team, rowing in the same direction for a really long time. And the climate movement is sort of just now being like, oh, maybe we should join with other movements. So, yeah.
I think that is sometimes hard because we get so siloed in what it is even that we cover, you know, and we know everything about the left nostril of a lemur, but, you know, we don't see the big picture of what's happening with the lemur in connection to everything else. So
the lemur's a Koch brother.
The lemur, definitely a Koch brother, definitely a Koch brother. I was reading a quote, I think it was in a UN document that I was reading that was saying that often the people in power to make decisions about climate and the impact of things that climate in this world are mostly old men, and that those who are the angriest about the pace of climate action are mostly young and female. Mm. What do you think about that?
That tracks from what I've seen.
Say that again.
Oh, sorry.
I think your mic.
Oh, it's pointing the wrong direction. I said, I mean, that tracks from what I've seen. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's not surprising. I think feminists have been angry at a lot of things for a long time, and rightly so. And I don't know if this is the report you were referring to, but we were all shared the UNFPA State of the World Population Report, and it really is groundbreaking in its reframing of how we think about demographic transition and this idea of demographic resilience, as opposed to thinking of population control and those kinds of unnuanced strategies. But that to think about demographic resilience, you have to address gender inequality. You cannot ignore it. You can't have half of the population under the thumb of patriarchy and say, we can handle whatever demographic shifts are gonna come our way. People have to be able to make solutions, and as you were saying, women have good solutions, infinite solutions, and so we have to do that work. We haven't been doing it, maybe because of silos, but it's not surprising that the women are angry.
And we have to also understand these silos that you're saying. When the climate change convention started and the work on climate change, it was a very white, male-driven, and they call it scientific and technical. There was no room for women, for color, to participate in a lot of these processes. But also the feminist movement worldwide had to walk a better understanding of all the jargon that is associated with climate change. What is mitigation? What is adaptation? What is LULUCF? What is this? What is that? And they have been running in that process, but there's still a lot that needs to be done in building those bridges between the environmental sector and the feminist sector when it comes to climate change.
I was impressed with a plenary yesterday to see that many women in charge. It was incredible to see people in a position of power, but women are only 4% of the World Energy Council, which is crazy, and a fewer of the third of UN member states have ever had a female leader. So there's a lot of work to do.
Sorry. I was also, hello.
Sorry, I'm an audio journalist.
I think it's important to remember too that like representation is good and matters, but it doesn't mean that like things will automatically change, right? Like slotting women in atop the patriarchy ain't gonna do it, you know. So I think thinking about larger structural change in general is really important when we're talking about these issues. There are lots of Phyllis Schlafly's still about, so I think we need to be kind of mindful about that too. I was just gonna say too, I had the opportunity of doing, I did a story for The Guardian like maybe 10-ish years ago on the link between reproductive choices and climate change. And I interviewed a bunch of people. My like thing I pitched was like, look, people make reproductive choices for a whole host of reasons, and like, you know, I'm not sure where climate sits in that, like climate concern at the time. And at the time, most people I talked to who said they were one of the reasons that they weren't going to have children was mm-hmm. because of climate change. The reason was that they didn't want to like further contribute to climate change, and they, you know, they were, especially if they were in global north countries, they were like, my child is going to have a huge footprint, blah blah blah. I got the chance to sort of redo that story more recently, and now people's choices are much more like, I'm terrified that a child I have today will be living through like the climate wars, mm-hmm. which is a very like huge and interesting and sad, you know, yeah. shift. So there again, like, I don't know, there are all these ways that these things tend to intersect, and I'm so glad that we're starting to see reports on, you know, demographic resilience instead of like, population is the problem and we need to address it, and the way to address it is less babies, and you know. So anyway, yeah.
Allie, I want to make sure we get to your story, because you really turned a power dynamic, you know, around in a really interesting way. And I just, can you tell them about medicated, meddlesome, and quarrelsome?
Yeah. I think just as what you're talking about, if you just slot women into places, that doesn't do anything. And I think what I appreciate about all of you guys are involved in so many different groups that support women and help them overcome these horrendous things that we still haven't changed, apparently. And so one of the power dynamics that we're talking about that I experienced was a professor at Boise State about a year ago stated that women are more medicated, meddlesome, and quarrelsome when they're in the workforce, and that fewer women should be recruited into STEM, medicine, law, and more men should be recruited. Wow. And so that set...
I said this out loud.
Not even out loud at a National Conservatism Conference. And so for everyone wow. to hear, and that hurts. Like, as a woman, again, that doesn't make you feel safe anywhere. That makes you feel like, I shouldn't be here. I'm not part of the solution. And so I thought, this cannot be. Like, how do we change that narrative? Because for me, I feel like I have a great support system that if a man says that to me, I'm going to probably laugh in his face. But there are girls and other women who, if they see that, say, I don't think I should enter that place. And so I said, the best way we can do this is to create a scholarship, because someone had stated that online. And I thought, okay, I'm going to run with it. So we opened a GoFundMe, started the scholarship. And right now the scholarship sits at about $450,000. And we awarded, woo, yes! And we awarded the first scholarship last year to Jessica Lambert, a Boise State student studying computer science and engineering. And we also have meddlesome merch, so if you want to wear it proudly, all the money goes to the scholarship. But this year's fundraising efforts, I'm raising $27,000 for the scholarship to add on top, because according to a 2019 report by the U.S. Census Bureau, 50% of women make up the workforce, but only 27% of women make up the STEM workforce, which again, how can we create solutions to these issues if women are not in the place where it's being discussed? Mm-hmm. So if you want to donate or buy a shirt and rock it, that would be phenomenal. And we changed medicated, meddlesome, and quarrelsome to motivated, mighty, and qualified, as all women are.
And it's so important to have a seat at the table in women in these fields, because they're going to be the decision makers in the future. But you're working for an engineering firm. Are there many women in your organization?
I do. I work for an engineering firm, and for Women's History Month in March, we had a fun report come out of their goals for women at the company and their representation. And our goal for women executives was 10% by 2030. And that was really sad. And I love that they have goals, but those are not the kind of goals we want. So there is so much more work to do, again, of why don't we have more women in those types of places? And those are questions we always have to be asking, of why is there not more women in the room?
And I don't mean to neglect my community, but I was looking at some of the studies about how climate disproportionately impacts the LGBTQ community as well, in very specific ways. 20-40% of teens who are currently not housed identify as a part of the community. So of course, climate disproportionately impacts people who are on the street. It says that
the LGBTQ community makes less money. So of course, if a disaster happens at their home, they have less opportunity, ability to recover. They live in neighborhoods just like other disenfranchised communities that are tend to be more polluted and tend to be vulnerable to disaster. Trans people, we can talk about, aren't always welcome in shelters for single gender people. Can we talk about that intersection a little bit? Anyone?
Yes, we're seeing a lot of those cases, especially in the Pacific Gen, where there are more and more organizations, LGBTQI organizations, really showcasing this impact on the members of those communities not being allowed to go into shelters during the disasters and being literally thrown out, and the high ratio of death associated because of that. So that is one of the linkages that we're definitely seeing at the more on the global south.
And if we want to make sure we have time for questions for people, so if folks want to start lining up, there's one microphone left. So over there, and keep in mind the policy of SEJ. Oh, okay, and we'll have another one. Is to have SEJ members ask the questions first, and also members of professional associations, journalism associations. If you could please keep it a question, not a statement, we would really appreciate it. And while you're setting up, I'll ask one more question to the panel, if that's all right. Amy, I've been thinking a lot about your book about motherhood, and you talk about how we have this culture of having to do things on your own, that it's up to just you. But clearly, this climate solution is going to take everyone, yeah, and at all sorts of levels. What are your solutions to getting people to get over that culture? I mean,
I wish I had a good solution for that. When I wrote that book, I had a lot of people in the climate space kind of be like, what the heck does motherhood have to do with climate change?
Is it working? There we go. Sorry. When I wrote a book about the role of motherhood in U.S. society and how it impacts women, whether they have kids or not, sort of how these ideas came about and where they came from and all that. And I had a lot of people in the climate space say, what the heck does that have to do with climate? What are you on the mom beat now? And to me, it has everything to do with climate. To me, they're very similar issues in that they are systemic issues that we are often being asked to solve on our own, and especially in the US. And we can't do that. We can't come up with individualized solutions to balancing, work and parenting any more than we can do it, for the climate crisis. I think that actually figuring that out is pretty clutch to figuring out not just climate, but kind of this whole intersection of issues that we have right now. Because you can't solve racism by being one nice white person either. You can't solve gender by being one nice guy. You know what I mean? It's not how it works. We need to have collective, systemic solutions that bring everybody together. How we do that, I don't know.
Well, yeah. Hopefully we have a room of people who will have ideas. All right, well, look at this great line. Go ahead. Make sure you tell us who you are and where you work and all that.
Sure. I'm Christy George. I'm co-chairing the conference, and I'm a news editor for KUOW Radio in Seattle. When I started covering the environment a while ago, few decades ago, the big issue involving gender was the need to educate women in order to give them the ability to make decisions about, or in order to get educated, women needed to be able to control their family size. And that, in turn, fed into the climate crisis by reducing population, because once women get educated, they tend to have fewer children. At least that was the theory. My question is, now we're seeing in the United States today what 20 years ago we were talking about in terms of the developing world and places where women had no power, and there's a big backlash politically in the U.S. I'm curious about the state of women's power, abortion, and family planning and trans rights as well in other parts of the world right now? And is there a backlash, too?
I think I could start. I'm sure others have thoughts. But, you know, what's interesting with the world compared with the U.S. is that actually the global trend on abortion laws and restrictions has been to ease those restrictions. And we've seen more momentum towards allowing abortion in more cases, which is the slow progressive realization of abortion rights. It's not always an immediate decriminalizing. It's sometimes it's okay in cases of rape or you know, up to this gestation, no questions asked. So we have seen that trend happening more, and there has also been backlash to that. And it's, you know, in line with what we're hearing earlier, that the backlash is also coming as we see more authoritarian regimes, anti-democratic movements that are really gaining traction, particularly in Europe and other parts of the world. So it's happening, and I think, it's interesting what's happening in the U.S., and I think that we're still in the shock phase, maybe, when it comes to abortion restrictions. I think what we will see 10 years from now, depending on how the movements respond now, in 10 years we'll see, are we entrenching into these types of restrictions on bodily autonomy and self-determination, or will we have a positive backlash that actually moves us maybe even farther in terms of access and rights and being able to decide your family based on what's real for you? Yeah.
Okay, so this question is, well, it's for all of you, but I specifically noticed that Gina used a very important term. At least in my opinion, people who can get pregnant. So language, as we all know, is very important as journalists. It's important that we use gender-inclusive language, like not all women can be pregnant or trans men can be pregnant. It's also important that we don't reduce people to body parts. So it's a hard line to navigate. I'm really curious what your guys' take on that is, especially Gina, since I did hear you use that term, and what you think about the term, the use of the term women in, you know, like journalism, I guess. Oh, and I'm so sorry. My name is Barb, and I'm a freelancer based in Missouri.
Does anyone else want to answer first? Or okay. Okay, I will just say we are certainly, you know, recognizing the need to be more inclusive in our language, and it's important because of, you know, targeting and being more exposed to risk as a trans person or as someone who is in the LGBTQ+ community. I think in terms of our global work, it's language is really important, even with abortion. For example, in Bangladesh, there's quite a progressive framework for abortion, but the language, you won't see the word abortion written. You'll see menstrual regulation. That it's in order to have progression, the language has to kind of match the, you know, what's socially acceptable. So I think we do sometimes in our country programming tend to use women and girls a lot. In a way that matches the sensitivities of wherever we are working, which is also important. You know, and sometimes we are you know, our language, we will hear your Western hang-ups, just use the language we use, and so we do that. But in all of our global materials, we are very much mindful that this is an important issue. Our language matters. I think when you're reporting, it matters. And it's really not, I mean, saying people who get pregnant is accurate and it's appropriate, so what's wrong with that? But we do recognize that women and girls have a disproportionate inequity that causes harm, so we do often use that language as well.
Hi, I'm Lisa Palmer. I'm a journalist and an author. I'm also a professor of science journalism, so I work with a lot of young people. But so in my book, Hot Hungry Planet, I write a lot about the intersectionality of global food security and climate change. And when I was reporting the story, I didn't set out to do this, but included in the story as a major theme is the gender equity piece, as well as, you know, how famine is and food security and feminism are really quite related, and the ability to access and plan and space the births of their children. So what my question to you, you know, is throughout your careers, we have accomplished scholars and journalists here on the panel. So what do you say to your editors or the people you're trying to communicate with when you want to tell your story about environmental issues, sustainability issues, you know, the these issues that are so much at a place of intersectionality, because they don't always fit neatly into the what we see as pillars. And so I've, you know, for me as a journalist, I've been writing to about more places and including my voice in more spaces and publishing in different places because people will put me not just in the science section or not just in the environment section. So how can you get your stories out more broadly because these are stories that really span so many more lanes than have typically been heard in the climate space?
Hello. Sorry. I'm going to figure it out right at the end. I think that editors at a lot of places, at least this has been my experience, that are much more open to the idea that climate is part of a lot of different stories. So I definitely pitch verticals that are, you know, gender or health or economics with stories that weave climate into those things. But I also think that editors are in the climate realm are getting a lot better at understanding that a climate story is not just a science story, that it's a story about power and politics and culture and law and all of these things. So I don't know. In terms of like formulating your pitch, I just would encourage people to lean into those intersections, because actually I've had the experience of it making stories more appealing to editors, especially if they're thinking, you know, along the lines of like, will this get readership? You know, will it reach a broad audience? All of that kind of stuff. The more intersections it has, the greater chance that more people will read it. That's been my experience.
You know, we're kind of siloed where I am. We used to be the health and climate unit, and then we split off, and now climate's separate, and I cover health. But so I just pitch it as, oh, here's this health story, but it happens to have climate in it. You know, and just kind of switch it around using the language that echoes whatever it is that the editors were particularly interested in. Because they will say, oh, that's a wellness story, even though we're, like, I don't even know what the difference is. So I just, again, try to mimic whatever the editor is asking for specifically, and then sneak all that other stuff in.
Hello, I'm Sonia, sorry, I haven't talked in a while. Sonia Narang, and I'm a radio journalist who's been covering this issue for the past 7 years for PRI's The World and NPR and other radio stations. So I'm very excited that this is a lunch plenary. I mean, I would never have imagined this even a decade ago, so it's exciting. But as you can see, everyone who lined up, as I can see, are people who don't identify as male. So, you know, as a reporter, I found that a lot of times my stories about the effect of the environment, climate change on women and, you know, girls and other marginalized communities are read or consumed by women. They're put in women's magazines. They were in the Lily instead of the Wash Post. They were in PRI's The World, Across Women's Lives section instead of, you know, front and center. How do you get the other half of the population to line up, ask these questions, and consume this information? Why is this not just a women's issue, but an entire issue? Like, why should it matter to everybody in the world? Can you just explain that?
I wish I had the answer.
Patriarchy?
To that.
No, well, tell us why it's an important issue that we should, like, why do women's issues affect the rest of the world? I mean, it seems like a really easy thing to talk about, but can you just explain, like, what should we put in our reports to preface this?
Yeah, because I have a friend who works in the cartoon industry, and she can't pitch a cartoon that focuses on just girls, because only girls will watch it, and they want the boy audience as well. So it crosses many disciplines. I do know that.
Right. It's like a question, like, why do refugee issues affect everybody? Like, how would it ripple into these issues of, like, women can't swim or women can't flee as fast? Like, why does it affect the entire population?
It's also the way that you craft your messages and who are you crafting them for. And the audiences are very different. For example, if you're talking to the audience of decision makers, there's a certain way that you have to craft your message so that they can make a connection when it's come to these things. When you're talking to researchers, you have to focus on your data and very, very structural type of information. So sometimes when we read, as people that are working in development, some of the work that journalists are putting out on this topic, sometimes that particular area of talking to a specific audience is missed. It's different for the different audiences that you want to reach. And that needs to be formulated and studied.
And I think this is more of an observation than an answer, but I think one of the things that we've noticed, you know, an abortion restriction affects more than just women, but to your point, to get policymakers to care about it and make decisions and change policies, we find ourselves having to talk about maternal death rates, so that it's like the number of people who have died, and so it takes that much. And I think there's something there about, I mean, we're talking about power, right? Patriarchy, power. You know, it's very hard to give up power when you have it, and it might be uncomfortable, and it might be a good question for some of the men here. Would you feel uncomfortable to get up and ask a question? Is it uncomfortable to recognize that you have power and that power, unless you give it up, someone else is going to suffer? And it takes, in our experience, sometimes it takes, the suffering has to be death, and that you're responsible for your population's health, and if this many women are dying from unsafe abortion, which is an easy and preventable thing because of your restrictive abortion law, so then we can get them to name it and speak on it. But in terms of gender empowerment and equality, that gets more uncomfortable, or it's easier to just ignore it and keep that power.
I think one thing that's frustrating about that is when you have to have the label of my sister, my daughter, my girlfriend, my mother, when they can actually see that direct impact, I feel like that's when they read, that's when they do something. So I guess maybe the question is, like, how do you create that personal connection to them of this impacts you every single time? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thank you so much. And if there's time later, I would love to hear some stories that, Jen, you've worked on that have looked at solutions to some of these problems, and Amy as well. So just from a journalistic perspective, how do you really get to the solutions that have been developed by women? Maybe give some examples of your stories. Yeah. But I know there's some other questioners here. So that's just later if you get a chance.
Sure, sure. Well, you can, I mean, you've come across some really good, both of you, I'm sure you've come across some really good programs that have solutions in them, right? Women changing the dynamic.
Completely. I will, if you go to Momentum for Change, it's an initiative under the Convention of Climate Change. You can see there Women for Results. You can see there incredible stories of what different women all around the world are doing as agents of change related to climate change, and the way that the message are being transmitted in energy, in renewables, in transport, even on fashion. So there is a lot of work. Consumption, I think that is something that we have not spoken today. It's not only population, it's also consumption. And I think that that is something that you can find a lot of information there.
And I have like two quick examples. Sorry. Two quick examples. One, I'll just give the one because I know we're short on time. I actually think that the big place that I'm seeing women be real drivers of like major change is in economics. Some of the economists that are like ecological economists looking at really, you know, how do we change demand? How do we reduce consumption? How do we balance, you know, addressing poverty with addressing the climate issue at the same time? Are women. The lead author of the Chapter 5 in the IPCC report on mitigation that came out towards the end of last year is Dr. Joyashree Roy. She's an Indian economist. That chapter is like kind of earth-shattering, actually, like the fact that, you know, the IPCC finally was like, oh, actually,
after 36 years,
yeah, we need to look at demand. And in general, I see, you know, Dr. Julia Steinberger is another one. There's a lot of really interesting economists who are doing work that's not just looking at, you know, what technology could we use to plug our stuff into, but like, how do we totally rethink how the economy works in really interesting ways? And they're doing, you know, peer-reviewed research. This is like very serious, credible work that I find particularly interesting right now.
Can I just give one very quick example of programming that I think a long-term, and we've tried to make it our programming as well, is a real focus on comprehensive sexuality education when it comes to sexual and reproductive health. It really is the solution to help young people understand their body, how it works, consent, what they, you know, human rights, self-determination, all of these principles at a young age is most definitely a solution and really challenging to do it. And it's, yeah, easier said than done, but a long-term solution to a lot of the issues that we're talking about.
And one of the other things that I am sure to do in any story, almost every story, is to make sure that my experts are people of color, women, and not just the three men that everyone always talks to about that particular topic. You know, because we can't be it if we can't see it, right? And I think about that all the time, and I make sure in my stories, the digital stories, that I link to those people's biographies so people can see that it's a deliberate effort on my part because we have such great experts, but they're not always putting themselves forward in a way. And I have this huge platform in which I can at least elevate those voices consistently. So it's just a simple, easy thing anyone could do.
That's amazing. Thank you. And I want to interview some of you as I continue to report. So thank you for being so insightful.
Thank you for that question.
Hi, thank you for being here. My name is Katie Dulk, and I'm from the University of Florida, soon to begin environmental reporting for TC Palm. So I want to ask you, as journalists, how can we be more mindful of protecting these vulnerable people's safety, especially thinking about abortion? I want to write about and have written about alternative routes to abortion, but I think we have to be mindful of their safety. And also, there are cases of activists and others giving us fake names. So I just want to hear how we can navigate that and also not be extractive when we are telling these stories to maybe promote accessibility.
I think, I mean, it sounds like maybe you're taking a really good approach of talking to the people that are most affected and letting their comfort determine how exposed they are in the article. There, right now, there is a lot of legal risk. There are a lot of networks that are not openly doing work, but they are doing work of getting pills into the hands of people who need them in states where there are restrictions. And there are many people who don't want to say a word about that. They don't trust anyone to know. And there are people who are willing to speak up. So if you're, you know, it's challenging to find them, honestly. We're not present as much in the US, and it's hard for us to find people who are doing this, but when you do, I think there you will find people who are not afraid to speak up, to use their name, and there are a lot of ways that people are kind of anonymously sharing their story. But first and foremost, you know, the people that you're working with, just asking them what their comfort level is. And I think being really mindful now for naming organizations, I think that's, you know, we have to be really careful because there is a lot of legal risk for groups that are doing this work. Just asking the question, I think, though, is part of the answer to it, though.
I would just say, too, like, in a really, like, logistical way, like, making sure that you're talking that person through exactly what you're going to be doing, exactly how you're going to be presenting them, getting their consent all along the way, letting them change their mind if they need to. Like, I think as journalists, sometimes we're so focused on getting the story that, like, it scares us to give sources the opportunity to walk away. But, like, I think it's important in this instance, like, being kind of flexible about that so that you're not putting someone at risk and that you're talking through, like, all the best ways to protect them, whether it's using a fake name or referring to them as an anonymous source. Like, working that out with them, I think, is really critical.
And I think, too, it depends on what their position is. So if it's an activist that is well aware of what that platform does, mm-hmm. and how that works, but if you're talking to, like, we always call them real people, you know, that policy impacts directly, I'm always really careful to have this conversation to say, you know, we're going to amplify your voice at not just this level, but at this level. And, you know, are you prepared for the hate mail that you're going to get? Are you and I never want to scare people off, but I do want to have that conversation with them, because they're going to get it, depending on what, you know, what the topic is. And most of the time, people are, I'm so impressed. If I have my worst day and somebody knocked on my door, I cannot imagine saying, yes, I'll talk to you. I would love to talk to you. And we're so lucky as journalists to have people who are generous with their stories. And even if they're going to get hate mail, a lot of the times people will speak up because they feel so passionate about wanting to do it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
Yeah. Hi, my name's Natalie Fleming. I'm here at Boise State University. And my audience is conservative Idaho, and I am conservative, and I've been bringing up environmental issues for the last 10 years with very strong, staunch conservatives here in Idaho. So my audience is incredibly challenging, as you can imagine. And I've seen this constant imbalance of what is the trending issues. So for me, I was a single mom of four, and my youngest has autism. And we know that trauma during the last months of pregnancy doubles the rate of autism, environmental issues. But when she was 7 years old, she had precocious puberty. And right now, the scientists are trying to tell us we need to worry about our endocrine disruptors in our ecosystem, from plastic, from chemicals to sprays. And so when a girl goes through puberty, her growth plates stop growing. They solidify. They close up. So she's shorter than everyone else in the family. And since she had autism, she'd only been speaking for 2 years. Can you imagine telling a second or third grade elementary school teacher, please make sure my daughter goes to the restroom at noon today to switch out her pad? And the news really isn't covering the massive disruption of our endocrine system in the developed world. And we have sperm counts have dropped 60%. The sperm mobility is down dramatically. I'm concerned about the reproductive ability of the next two generations, considering how bad things are getting. Precocious puberty the elementary school teachers are saying we need to have more sanitary supplies in the elementary schools because of precocious puberty. And we know that these endocrine disruptors affect the hormone balances of our young girls. Imagine trying to explain to an autistic child their mood swings and then sending them to an angry father who doesn't know how to manage. But so how do we get this message out? And I just feel like there's so much imbalance on the trending environmental issues. So this is not a trending environmental issue, but it's there. And how do you bring attention and take things like this that are affecting the developed world? And I would be curious to see, I don't know if the studies have been done in the rest of the world on how these endocrine disruptors in our food supply are affecting them.
Well, I would just say that they're actually, the endocrine disruption thing was a trending topic like 10 years ago. It was huge. It was everywhere. And I don't really understand why it's like diminished so much, which would be an interesting story to look into. But plastic is a big, you know, kind of trending topic right now. So, I mean, I usually it's kind of like, okay, well, how can I, if I'm interested in or passionate about this one topic, how do I, like, you know, hitch that wagon to whatever is like the topic of the day, right? So in this case, if you're looking at endocrine disruptors and plastic, you know, plastic is a huge issue in general.
It affects male and female hormones from early development, and it passes through the placenta. So the children are born with gender hormone changes because of the endocrine disruptors.
Yeah. I mean, there's been a bunch of studies about it. I actually covered this for The Guardian 10, 15 years ago extensively, and as did lots of other people in this room. I'm not sure why it's dropped off. But, you know, that could be looking at, you know, trying to dig into why the coverage has reduced in recent years could be an interesting story. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, beyond that, I always just look for, like, okay, well, what are the topics that are trending, and how can I kind of like shoehorn this issue into those? Usually it's not that hard. Like, so many environmental issues are connected that, like, if you start looking, you can find a connection between like your particular thing and whatever is trending at the moment too.
And we're like a study driven news organization and in the health unit. So if there are new studies about that that are legitimate, you know, from good peer-reviewed journals, we do cover it. I know I've covered it over the years. So perhaps there's just nothing breaking in that field right now, but I'm sure there are people working on it, so we'll definitely pay attention.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Mizrahi, and I'm a climate philanthropist, so I'm not a journalist. But I was really just inspired by that mom. I'm also an autism mom, and my daughter also has cerebral palsy, and I brought a group of young women with autism who care about climate change to a Greta Thunberg event because she was in Washington, and they played loud music at the beginning, and so none of the women with autism could stay because the university refused to turn off the music to accommodate the people with autism in the audience. And I'm asking because one in five people now has a disability, and most climate activity, most climate justice movements are not accessible to people with disabilities. They're not putting their captions on for their Zoom events and webinars. They're not making their facilities. I mean, if a wheelchair user wanted to get on this stage, you would have to have a different way to get on this stage. They're just not accessible to women with disabilities who are disproportionately impacted by all the things you've been talking about. So I'm wondering if this is a part of your beat, both covering the impacts on people with disabilities and also enabling the women and men with disabilities to participate in coming up with solutions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a huge issue because also, you know, in most cases, in all of the stuff we were talking about in terms of disaster preparedness too,
correct,
like none of that is taking disability into account, disability of any kind. It's like, you know, what happens when you have a power outage and there are people who are dependent on particular types of machines to function on a day-to-day basis? How are we, you know, are we, like in most cases, that's not even being tracked. Like which people do we need to get their power on first because, you know, they have a health issue that's dependent on that. So at a really basic level, it's such a huge blind spot in the climate space. I do see more effort being made in the last few years to include disability as one of the sort of intersections, in both policymaking and in journalism and, you know, kind of messaging. But I think it's, you know, it's like where this conversation was 10, 15 years ago, unfortunately. And I think there's a whole lot more work that's needed.
What we also have to understand is that the climate change world has been very difficult to bring a human face to climate change. And it has taken us 30 years to address some of those issues, like bringing women and girls at the forefront. Now, to recognize the diversity of human beings in the climate change arena is still a step forward. I mean, disability, LGBTQI, in general, it's taking us longer. And believe me, it's faster in some countries, more developed countries. But in the global south, to address, for example, LGBTQI rights in the climate change arena, it's an almost an impossible work to be done. So, I mean, we're walking, but not as fast as those people that are really having a differentiated impact on climate change are suffering it every day.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking that.
Hi, my name is Amelia Ascari, and I teach environmental journalism at the University of Michigan. So over the years, we've had many sessions at SEJ focused on how to localize climate stories. Mm-hmm. And my question is, what are your very quick top tip ideas about localizing this systemic story that you've been describing and discussing?
Good question.
Well, I am an anthropologist, and I have to say they have to be cultural pertinent, and they have to be in the right language and according to the context that you're working with. You cannot globalize the particularities of a given country and of a region community, and they need to be targeted and very specific for the culture. As you were saying, I mean, the words that we use and the way that we say it is extremely important in the context that you're working. So that will be my only advice.
Well, and then I think a lot of the stuff that that Jen mentioned too about sourcing, you know, like there are always going, I mean, in general, there would be, you know, local sources that you could use that are either women or female identifying people or LGBTQI people who, you know, you can represent in your stories. I think it's you can kind of always find local examples of where gender and climate are intersecting. You know, what happened in the most recent extreme weather event? Were there particular women who were impacted by it and or who organized to help people through it? Are there local organizations that are particularly addressing this issue? I was talking to someone the other day who was working in Mexico and had gone into a mining community, and like a labor organizer there was like, don't talk about environmental issues. Like they think the environmental movement killed this town, you know. So instead they went in and they spent a lot of time in the town. They realized that like 70% of the town were widows whose husbands had died in this coal mine. And the widows were, they all wanted to like grow food and have a place to meet, and they didn't have that. And so instead of kind of coming in and being like, let's talk about climate and women and environment, they created a community garden. And the women, the widows of the town started to run that garden. And then, you know, that became like a huge story about the town. So anyway, I think it's like, you can always kind of find these stories of, you know, half the population dealing with climate and various other environmental issues wherever you live.
I came across something when I was looking at the LGBTQ information, and there's something called Section 308 of the Robert Stafford Disaster Relief Program that prohibits discrimination, and it's for nearly every category except LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh, well, that's next time there's a disaster in your backyard, that's a good conversation to have, you know, because I'm sure there are problems.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I think.
Sorry. Okay. Hi, I'm Megan Parker. I'm the executive director of SEJ, and I'm going to take the privilege of the last question here because it's one I think about a lot about our association and our field. When I first joined the board of SEJ 10 years ago, the majority of members were men, and that has changed. And now the majority of our members are identify as women, and our conference attendance also reflects that shift. And Amy and I were talking earlier about this and saying, well, what's the driver here? You know, is it because of interest in the issue in particular? And I said, well, maybe it's because, you know, we're more freelancers and that's a more flexible job for women who are caring for children or for their parents. And Amy, I think, said, well, maybe it's because it just pays less, you know. And so that's the question I have. How can we help elevate as we look at this shift, which you know, is not, we should welcome, but also how do we make sure that it doesn't make it a pink collar job, which have traditionally been paid less, you know, than men in those fields?
I have one thing to say about this. I think pay transparency is really huge here. Like sharing rates, staff, you know, pay for staff jobs, all of that. Like everyone kind of knowing what everyone else is getting paid would be very helpful. I also was just talking to some folks in the Freelance Solidarity Project the other day who are in the process of trying to push for outlets to pay by time instead of by word, which I think would be a game changer. So, you know, things like that where, like, it's like any other labor organizing, right? For some reason, journalists have traditionally been quite bad at that, at least in, like, recent years, but all of a sudden the last few years it's starting to shift. So, you know, all of the... I think sometimes like the competitiveness of media works against solidarity amongst all of us who are workers in this industry in a way that's somewhat unhelpful. So the more we can be like sharing information with each other about, you know, yeah, pay rates, working conditions, all of that stuff, I think the better off we'll all be, irrespective of gender.
Should we do a salary survey? Would everybody participate in that?
That would be great.
Yes. Would you? Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And thank you, Megan, for doing this. This has been such an amazing experience. And I'm so glad to see a transformation because this is really powerful. Do we have some last thoughts that we want to share or a story idea that we should be having people so that they can write about this right away?
We can start. I feel like I shared too many thoughts. I don't know. I guess I would, I would just again, like recommend that people look at how much crossover there is in the people and the organizations that are trying to stop climate policy and those that are trying to stop women's bodily autonomy and work against the rights of lots of different humans in general.
I think my final thought is one of our speakers kind of covered it, of how do we get men to read more articles and how do we ourselves read more articles about things that we don't perceive really impact us when they really do. So read the article that you don't think impacts you, because it will, and it does.
I think for me, recognizing the point earlier that the anti-rights folks are all kind of the same, so whether it's anti-climate or anti-abortion, I think there's an interesting story in looking at how you can take a healthcare service that is central to autonomy and self-determination, and you throw it into a political machinery, and here we are today. And you could look at what's happening with abortion now as a politically fraught issue, and all the suffering that's happened since it began getting more heavily restricted in this country, and who has borne the brunt of that, and what happens when you turn a basic health care service into a political hot button issue. It'd be interesting.
Well, I come from the Global South, and journalists sometimes are the only source that we have. You are sometimes the difference between our life and our death. And when it comes to gender equality, I usually said, I wish there will be a vaccine like the coronavirus, but there's no vaccine against gender inequality. And sometimes you are the only front that is left for a lot of women and girls and people from LGBT communities that we can hold on for our life and our safety. So please keep on doing it. But remember that these women is diverse. This world is diverse. and that we're not all the same, and we don't face climate change the same way. Thank you.
Well, on that note, thank you so much. Thank you.